session number 16075, reel 3.
Group Captain Goodman, reel 3.
The first of the pictures was of the marshalling yard before the raid, and the second was after. And the photograph taken after the raid shows what can best be described as a moonscape, I think. The whole of the marshalling yards have been chewed up, and bomb craters overlapping. But what was more important than that was that all the engine roundhouses, the engine repair facilities, were all knocked out. And this was a feature of all these attacks on the marshalling yards. And there were 80 of them, by the way. They were divided between Bomber Command and the 8th Air Force, and we took 40 each. Bomber Command dropped something like 42,000 tons of bombs in the period between April 1944 and the 6th of June, and the Americans dropped about 1,800 tons. And our bombing was more accurate than theirs, and the reason for it was that we marked each end of the yard, if you remember, and each bomber bombed independently, flying between the two blobs of red and dropping between the two blobs, whereas the Americans used to fly in formation. And when the leader, the lead ship, dropped his bombs, everybody else dropped bombs. But they were not all concentrated one behind the other, and so the bombing tended to be rather more spread than ours was. And this was shown very clearly on another attack we did at about the same time. We didn't keep bombing just marshalling yards, we bombed other targets as well. And one of them we went for was a place outside Tours. It was an aero engine works called the Usine Liquetard. And we saw the target maps and photographs. We used to examine these, of course, all day before we went on the trip, so we knew exactly what it all looked like. And we saw what the Americans had done a few days before, or had not done. There were bomb craters in the fields all around the works, and as far as we could see, none on the works itself. Or if there were any, there might have been one or two, but that's all. So we went for it, and I'm happy to report that that night I was the first marker on and got the first markers down. The technique we used, by the way, we must cover this. We had two Pathfinder Lancaster squadrons with us in five group by then, 83 and 97, they were equipped with H2S, and they went ahead of everybody else and dropped flares over the target area. And these flares ignited at 5,000 feet and came out on parachutes, or they came out on parachutes first and then ignited at 5,000 feet, so a great carpet of light was thrown downward. And the mosquitoes would come in under the light at about 2,000 feet. It was as light as day. And we would look around and find the target. And then the first marker, and we used normally to have four on, the first marker would call his call sign and tally-ho. And that was a sign for all the others to get the hell out of it, keep out of the way. So on this particular night, I called Pennib 3-7, that was me, Pennib 3-7, tally-ho, and opened the bomb doors and dived on the works. Unfortunately, I was a bit too keen, I think. I got the markers bang in the middle, but they went through the glass roofs of an engine repair shop and ignited inside, which meant that to some extent they were shielded from the view of the main force approaching, about 200 bombers coming up behind Lancaster's. So the next marker, who was called in, was told to put his markers alongside this particular engine shop, which he did. So there was a great big blob of red in the end, in the centre of these works, and the Lancs came in and plastered it, and that was the end of the Usine Liquetard. That was just another one of these trips. Another one was that Field Marshal Montgomery, I beg his pardon, he was a general then still, wasn't he? OC 21 Army Group, decided that a very important target had got to be eliminated, and that was the tank repair depot at Mailly-le-Camp down near Epernay. This was also the headquarters of the 21st Panzer Division. It had been a French artillery depot with a big artillery firing range, and it was just the right sort of area for tank manoeuvres, and the Germans used it for that. But anyway, we were detailed to go and attack this place. The idea was to knock out as many tanks as we could that might be there. What we didn't know was that the operational armour left Mailly on the day we went there. In other words, in the morning it left and we arrived in the evening. But that wasn't the primary object of the raid. The primary object was to knock out all the tank repair facilities and kill as many Germans as possible, because a large number of these people were what the Americans called crew chiefs, so that when a damaged tank came in for repair, one of these highly trained senior NCOs and his crew would take it over and put it right. So we arrived over Mailly-le-Camp and hammered it, and the pictures of that raid are very good indeed, and they show great bomb holes in all these tank repair sheds. Tanks inside were destroyed, but also the Germans themselves were in slit trenches all over everywhere, and many bombs hit slit trenches and killed all the Germans in them. And something like 250 highly trained German senior NCOs were killed in that raid, which meant that it was a terrible blow to the Germans. These aces would not be available to repair tanks once the battle was joined in Normandy. We lost 42 Lancasters during this raid, because it was a night of the full moon and the night fighters found us. It was also a night on which Bill Hickox and I very nearly got the chop, because I did a very stupid thing. We did our bombing and then turned away at low level. We should normally have climbed up to 25,000 feet and come back at high level, but I thought I'd be clever, and we headed for the Pas-de-Calais at low level. And we had not been flying many minutes before suddenly we were picked up by a searchlight, and then another, until we were coned at low level in searchlights. And I dived down to about 500 feet above the ground, with Bill Hickox exhorting me to watch the instruments. And there we were in this great glare of light. And at once up came the light flak towards us, and we'd see red and green and white shells going past, exploding. A terrible plop, plop and bang, bang as these things went off, but miraculously we weren't hit. And of course we were weaving like fun this way and that, but making a steady, mean course towards the coast. And eventually, I shall never forget it, a normal Bill Hickox, we got almost to Le Tréport, breasted a low hill, with searchlights shining up behind us, and shining then above us, because we went over the hill and down towards the sea. We could see the sea ahead of us, light of the full moon, if you remember. And there was this light, a great patch of light ahead of us from the searchlights. No longer could we be fired at by these guns. We'd got past this light flak belt, and in no time at all we were going up the river estuary at Le Tréport. And we passed the lighthouse at Le Tréport below the level of the light. It must have scared the daylights out of the lighthouse keeper. At least I hope it did, if he was a German. And were so you, home.
Were you aware on that raid of the heavy Lancaster losses?
Yes. We could see the developing air battle up top. And as soon as a Lancaster was hit, it would catch fire. Well, the Germans had a technique for setting them on fire. They fired outboard of the bomb bay. They weren't going to hit the bomb bay in case the bombs went off. So it was always outboard of the bomb bay, usually to starboard, and they would set the tanks on fire. So you would first of all see this plume of fire coming back, and then the whole aircraft would be a huge ball of fire, and it might explode. And we down at low level had these great flaming balls of fire heading towards us, and you could look at them and think they were going to hit you, and of course they wouldn't. They'd be off a mile or two, but something coming down from 18,000 feet in your general direction is coming at you, believe me.
Which of these three raids, the Mailly-le-Camp, the Usine-Lichtar, or else the Juvisy marshalling yards, were the most hair-raising for you?
The most hair-raising was Mailly-le-Camp, because I think we should have been shot down. we came back at low level, you see, and we were being fired up by light anti-aircraft fire at very low level. We might easily have flown into the ground, but we didn't. And we might easily have been hit, but we weren't. Nor was the aircraft scratched, and this is amazing. Another thing about this trip, someone else had a hair-raising experience, one of the other markers. He came back, and somehow or other he managed to run into the balloon barrage around Ipswich. The Navy were there, and they loved to fly these wretched balloons over their ships. Of course, we were not supposed to go over Ipswich anyway, but this character somehow or other managed to do so. And suddenly he felt a bump, and the mosquito slewed a bit in the air, about 10 or 20 degrees, and then levelled out again and headed on. And he thought that one wing was a bit low, and he tried the controls, and she was a bit one wing low, but otherwise performed all right. And he got back to the airfield and landed and told the ground crew about this. So they shone a light on the mosquito, and to their astonishment found that the starboard wing, outboard of the engine, or rather the starboard leading edge of the wing, had been sheared off completely. What had happened was that he had driven into one of these wretched balloon cables outboard of the propeller. Thank God for that. If it had been inboard, it might have come in through the cockpit and killed them both. Outboard of the propeller, so it didn't hit the prop, but it hit the leading edge and then slewed the aeroplane in the air and scraped along the main spar, which was made of spruce, and away off the wingtip, scooping off the whole of the leading edge. Well, when you do that sort of thing with an aeroplane, if you take the leading edge off the wing, normally the aeroplane becomes uncontrollable. But the mosquito could take it, and this was demonstrated. And he was a very lucky man. Why the balloon cable didn't just shear straight through the whole wing, we shall never know.
And after the Mahi raid, were there any others that specially stuck out in your mind?
Yes. We went to the big city, to Berlin, one night, and started back. We'd been shot at, and we had not gone all that far back. I think we got to about Hanover, and suddenly I noticed that the oil pressure was beginning to fall on the starboard engine, and the coolant temperature was rising. Which was a bad sign, and the oil temperature rose too. And I said to Bill Hickox, just look at that. When the oil pressure gauge reached rock bottom, and at the same time the coolant temperature was way over, and I realised that the engine was going to seize any second, so pressed the feathering button on the starboard engine, throttled back the engine, pressed the feathering button, and the Merlin and the prop would feather in just a few seconds. It was really a case of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and it was stopped. And it didn't catch fire, and it didn't seize up. But unfortunately, the generator, we had only one generator, and that was on the starboard engine, and it drove all the electrics. So we had to turn everything off and sit in the darkness, trim the aircraft as well as we could. Well, you could trim it hands and feet off, in fact. It would fly perfectly well on one engine. Trimmed off, you could take your hands and feet off, it would fly itself. And home we came, but instead of being at 25,000 feet, we had to lose height now, and we were down at 18,000 feet alongside our heavy brothers, which was all right, but we were completely vulnerable. If we were attacked by a night fighter, well, that would be the end of us, because we had nothing to defend ourselves with at all, no guns on the bomber Mosquito at all, we just carried bombs. So we bored on through the dark until we got over Holland in G range of this country. And then Bill, we turned on the electrics, and Bill turned on the G set. And fortunately, thank goodness, there was enough urge in the battery to work the G set. And he calculated a fix which showed exactly where we were. And then he plotted a course for base. And we carried on, and then when we were halfway across the North Sea, I called up that we were Pendib 3-7 on one engine heading for home, and the most gorgeous voice you ever heard came back, and I'm sure that these girls were chosen because of their lovely voices. Pendib 37, transmit for homing. And I called her up and said, Pendib 37, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, over, and back she came, steer 295, steer 295. And then she said, friends are with you. And we looked round behind us, and there was a bow fighter. They had vectored a fighter aircraft onto us, a bow fighter, and he escorted us. At least he protected our tail all the way to the English coast. And then we flew on to base and landed fairly expertly, though I say it myself, and it drew from Mr. Hickox, who was imperturbable. You couldn't move him at all. Two words, good show, which was praise indeed.
I do think we mentioned a raid on the 1st of June 1944, which you had on the Saumur marshalling yard.
Yes. We weren't to know it, but this was to be our final trip. It sounds very strange that we should stop then, when the invasion was only 5 days away, but we did operate tours. You did a tour of duty, and when you reached your requisite number of trips, you stopped. The fact of the matter was that by then, the chop rate in Bomber Command generally had reduced greatly because the Germans were being shot out of the sky in all directions. And even though we sustained bad casualties on places like Mai, most of the time we didn't. And so when people got to their allocated number of sorties, they stopped. And it so happened that this was the last one for Bill and myself. It was our 38th mosquito trip. We were supposed to do 30. I did mention earlier that if you did a second tour on heavies, you did 20 trips. If you did a second tour on mosquitoes, you were supposed to do 30 trips. So that in all, you would do 60 trips. But by the time Bill and I had finished this one, we had done 78 in all, which was way over the top. We had done more on Wellingtons as well than we should have done. Instead of doing 30, we'd done 40. So everybody can see that this is the way the cookie crumbled at times. So we weren't to know it at the time, of course, and we were briefed for this particular raid. And as usual, it was a copybook five-group attack. We were briefed in the morning, and we went to the AOC's briefing in the afternoon. I haven't mentioned this before, but what happened was that the marker pilots that were on were permitted to attend the AOC's hookup, which meant that you went into your briefing room, your squadron commander was there, and the squadron commander of 617, who was Leonard Cheshire, and all the marker pilots, and the station commander, and the station commander of all the stations in the groups, and the squadron commanders of all the stations in the groups were there. And the AOC would say a few words about what he thought of this particular raid, and any particular things he wished to be attended to. And very often he would say, tonight we've really got to make sure of getting this one, and I want everybody to come down to, shall we say, 8,000 feet, which would create a fuss among the squadron commanders who didn't like that. They liked the Lancasters to be up at 18,000 feet, or perhaps they'd come down to 12, but they didn't like the idea of coming down to 8. But obviously the lower they got, the more accurate they would become. And so on some of these marshalling yard trips, that's what they had to do. And the AOC in the end would say flatly, that is what you are to do. And I'll never forget on one particular trip, he said, and tonight you must get this target. And if you don't get it tonight, then you'll go tomorrow night, and you'll go the night after that, and every night until you do get it. So that's an indication of what the AOC would say. So they're on briefings. The squadron commanders will make it clear to their crews, you have got to get this target, and no argument. And the AOC wants us to do it. So let's get cracking. This is the way it would be done at the station. Marker pilots never said anything. We were just there listening into what was said. We knew what we had got to do. So on this particular trip, off we went. The heavies went away first. Of course, they were in the air usually a couple of hours before we ever took off, because we caught them up and passed them. But there is one other thing about this that I do remember so very well. An ENSA concert party was on the station, and they used to do some jolly good shows for the troops. And on this particular night, they got a piano mounted up on the back of a three-tonner, and they went round to the dispersals. and they got someone, a very good pianist and a very good soprano, girl soprano. She was a dish, she really was. And I remember they came to our dispersal, the Lancs had all gone. And it was made clear to these rough, tough mosquito people that this girl was going to sing a song. And we all looked bleakly at her, the poor soul. And the pianist started up, and it was to be Dream a Day Jill, one of Edward German's songs. And she sang it beautifully, I remember. And we did clap her in a sort of half-hearted way. And away she went, blushing crimson, away around the perimeter track to do the same thing for some of the Pathfinder, at some of the Pathfinder dispersals where the ground crews were all assembled. And away we went with the tune of, the song Dream a Day Jill ringing in our ears, I suspect. But we flew over to Saumur and, as I said, we caught up the Lancasters and got ahead of them. And the Lank Pathfinders were ahead of them, dropping their flares, and we flew in underneath them, arriving over the target at 0-5 minutes. I hadn't made that clear earlier on. We had to be there at 0-5 minutes. We've got 5 minutes in which to mark and get out of the area. And this we proceeded to do in the time-honoured fashion, two blobs of red at each end of the marshalling yard. Marker leader flew in and announced to the master bomber up top that the markers were all in place and it was safe to go ahead. And the master bomber then gave the all clear for the heavies to come in and bomb, which they did. And the yard was destroyed, and the Bomber Command war diaries announced triumphantly that the bombers were led by four Mosquitoes and all aircraft returned safely, which I think was really quite superb so far as I was concerned. It was something I didn't often encounter. Almost always somebody was lost, either from your squadron or several Lancasters or Halifaxes. This time everyone returned safely, and that was a good point at which to end, I think.
Is it possible to go back just a bit earlier to
yes.
some of the earlier raids you did? Because I think that we haven't said anything about when you bombed Brunswick, Munich and Schweinfurt. Was it the spring of 1944?
Yes. Brunswick, that was a German target we went for. We've rather wondered what the low-level marking would be like on German targets. We had been bombing French ones, you see, and we got used to that. No one quite knew what it would be like on a German target. So we went for Brunswick, and the technique this time was that the wind, as I recall it, was blowing from the northeast, and the idea was to make an enormous great blob of red in a park on the northeast side of Brunswick, which is what we did. So we didn't have to fly over Brunswick itself, and we weren't shot at. In any case, around German targets, they were always much too preoccupied with blasting away with their 88mm guns at the heavies up top. They didn't bother with the Mosquitoes at low level. To some extent, it was easier to go to a German target than to a French one, where they did have these nasty light anti-aircraft guns at low level, specifically for aircraft like us. So we could be virtually unopposed at low level. Well, we made this great blob of red. And then the heavies came in, and the master bomber, of course, had to make allowances for the fact that this blob of red was about a mile upwind of the aiming point, which was the middle of Brunswick. The navigator in the master bomber's aircraft had to calculate a false wind, allowing for this difference, so that the heavies would put on their bomb sights this particular wind, the false wind calculated by the master bomber, and they would come and they would bomb on the reds, which they could see, but because a false wind was fitted to their bomb sights, the bombs would undershoot and hit the target area. Now, it's the first time we'd ever tried this one, and it was outstandingly successful. Usually, what we used to do was to mark the middle of a target, the middle of a town or a city, for example, so that when the bombs were dropped, the markers could be blown out and you'd be faced then with remarking. Usually what happened, of course, was that you made a great conflagration and the heavies could see it all burning, and they would come in and just bomb the middle of what they could see, which was very good. But this was a technique used. Later on, it was further modified in that we would have the same kind of arrangement, a big blob of fire on upwind of the target area, false winds laid on the bomb sites of the Lancasters and Halifaxes coming up behind, and then they proceeded to bomb on different headings so that they went over a particular aiming point. I'm sorry, there was a further aiming point, a further point before they got to the target area over which they turned. And they turned, shall we say, to the northeast, to the east, to the southeast, to the south. So a great fan of bombing would be created, and this was used with outstanding effect on one of the German cities. I've forgotten which one it was now, which virtually destroyed it in one raid. That again was a further refinement of this technique of having the offset marker in use.
You mentioned just now three of the great personalities in Bomber Command, Cheshire, Cochrane and Bennett.
Bennett, yes.
Are there word portraits you can paint of them from your own personal contact with the three of them, please?
Yes. I got to know Leonard Cheshire quite well in those days. I was only a miserable flight lieutenant and he was a wing commander. And, of course, wing commanders weren't noted for having anything to do with flight lieutenants except to tell them to stand to attention and say, sir, which we used to do. I got to know Cheshire very well after I retired, in fact, because I went to work for one of his homes down in Devon at Tamerton Folliot, and I used to see him from time to time. By then I'd become a group captain and he was a group captain, so I could talk to him on level terms, as it were. But in those days, of course, we all admired him greatly. He had been CO of the Dambuster for some time before we got there, and we had not met his predecessor Gibson, although we did afterwards, because Guy Gibson was a group staff officer at number 54 base, which was Coningsby, our base, and he somehow or other managed to get himself on the battle order one night in September 1944 to be the master bomber. The thing is somewhat shrouded in mystery. There's been a new book on Gibson this summer, which I think glosses over it rather, but he somehow managed to get himself on as master bomber, and somehow or other he managed to get himself a little bit of experience in flying the Mosquito, and he came over to Woodhall Spa from Coningsby to take one of our aeroplanes, a 627 squadron aeroplane, which he did, and he didn't come back. He went to Mönchengladbach Right as master bomber and was there as master bomber directing the raid, and then said, all right, chaps, let's go home. And he started for home and got over Holland at a place named Bergen op Zoom, where suddenly at about 3 o'clock in the morning, this was, people on the ground heard engines spluttering and saw cockpit lights on. And then this aeroplane, they didn't know what it was, came down in an arc and hit the ground and exploded. And it was Gibson and Squadron Leader Warwick in this Mosquito. And Warwick was buried, and the other airman was not named at the time. I don't know why. Perhaps he wasn't carrying his identity discs, his tags, or perhaps the Dutch